If you like what you hear on the Security Ledger podcast, you might want to check out one of our cybersecurity newsletters like the Daily Ledger or the Weekly Ledger. You can sign up for them at securityledger.com/subscribe. Hello and welcome to the Security Ledger podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. In this week's episode number 85, we continue our celebration of Black History Month in the United States by talking to prominent information security professionals from the Black community. This week, our guest is Leon Johnson, a principal pen tester at the firm Rapid7, who talks to us about becoming the first person in his family to go to college and then finding his way to the information security field. But first, the firm CrowdStrike released its latest global threat report, summing up the biggest threats from 2017 and giving us a look at what's waiting ahead for us in 2018. In our first segment, CrowdStrike Vice President of Intelligence Adam Myers is back in the studio to talk about the most salient trends of the last 12 months and what awaits us in the year ahead. To start off our conversation, I asked Adam to talk about what cyber threats were keeping him up at night.
Adam Myers, Vice President of Intelligence. There's a couple of trends that I would highlight. The first one that I think is really interesting and is probably the one that keeps me up at night is we've seen a trend over the course of 2017 for threat actors of both the criminal and the nation-state espionage actors going after supply chain. And when we say supply chain, we're talking about the software that companies rely on for various things, that they don't necessarily have control over how that software is developed or where it was developed or any vulnerabilities or, in some cases, updates that are pushed to that software. And so we've seen a number of different events over the course of the last year, but increasingly over the last 6 months and really the last quarter of the year, where threat actors were targeting these software applications that a lot of different organizations use and putting back doors in them. A great example of this was the distribution of a number of destructive ransomware-like software packages, not Petya being one of them, where they were distributed through the update mechanism of a Ukrainian software company that builds software that's responsible for, you know, being able to file taxes and things like that. And there was an update mechanism that was backdoored and allowed a threat actor to push arbitrary executables essentially through that update mechanism. And we watched a number of things get deployed through it, starting with a malware package called Xdata in May of 2017, all the way up through, there were a couple of different things that got pushed, and finally NotPetya was distributed through that mechanism as well. So that's one of the things that we saw in 2017. There was another really significant event with CCleaner, which is a security software, and that looked like there were maybe some ties to China potentially from that incident. They were able to successfully infect a number of different targets that they were interested in through attacking that backdoor mechanism. And you know that gets us into another interesting trend that we identified in 2017. We've seen an increase in nation states using ransomware as a cover for being able to run destructive attacks. It's not just Russia. We've seen Iranian actors involved in this type of thing. We've seen there was some things that were targeting Israel that were of interesting origin. So there's, this was a trend where the threat actors are able to make it appear as if something is actually ransomware, which is, as we know, it's a very prevalent threat that's out there. And by making a destructive attack appear to be ransomware, it often can offset the investigation or how people treat that attack.
Yeah, I was going to say, what's the advantage for the attacker in making it look like ransomware? Is it merely that they want to leverage the ransomware platform to gain access or exfiltrate data or whatever their real objective is? Or is it that they want to sow doubt and confusion about who is behind an operation and what their objectives are?
Well, I think in some cases it was to cause disruption. In the case of NotPetya and Bad Rabbit and some of these attacks, the intention, I think, was to attack really the morale of people of Ukraine and really trying to continuously bombard them with disruptions and make them kind of feel some hopelessness and some other kind of emotions related to the relationship that's going on between Ukraine and Russia. I think in other cases, in the case of some of the Iranian stuff or suspected Iranian stuff that we've been looking at, they were trying to influence people's behavior by creating ransomware that would steer would-be users of VPN software away from using it.
For folks who are working in industry, it's a very troubling picture because really, what do you do from the defense or the risk assessment side if you've got a signed, seemingly legitimate software update from a software application that you've been using probably for a long time and trusted, but that third-party software vendor has suddenly become compromised? What can you really do to counter something like that? It's so stealthy and sophisticated. And at the end of the day, you do have to trust your business partners and your third-party software providers, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's exactly why that keeps me up at night. I don't know that there's really a good answer for that at this time. I think you have to really understand what software you're using across your enterprise. You have to understand where it's used and how it's used and really implement security controls around it. You have to kind of isolate these things and make sure that you can factor into your risk planning what happens if this software company was compromised in a backdoor by somebody that wants access to my systems. And it's not just nation states. We've seen a couple of instances where it looked like criminal actors were using open source projects and backdooring those. This is a trend that we're seeing by across definitively the criminal actors and the espionage actors. You know, I think it's going to take a while for people to start to really factor this into their risk planning.
What do you really tell companies if one of the morals of this is that these geopolitical disputes, for example, between Russia and Ukraine, that have really moved from, you know, the real world into the information space, could kind of spill over, that there could be collateral damage, or they could spill over onto your network and into your business operations, just even accidentally, even if you're not a target. But you could be a target also.
Yeah, we've been telling people that for years now. I think even the 2015 Global Threat Report, we had a whole section on cyber spillover. And it's problematic because you can find yourself very much in the crosshairs. I think from the offending nation perspective, Russia's perspective on something like that is, well, great, maybe other businesses will be less likely to do business with Ukraine because they're worried about something like a NotPetya. And that further increases the effect of what they meant to do. So I think that there is certainly the potential for this cyber spillover to occur. And I think in some cases, you know, it's things that these nations may even plan for, right? You can use it to even improve the effect of what you've done. And for businesses that are in that position, you know, it doesn't take a lot of legwork to take a look at your organization and say, oh, we've got contractors in Ukraine, or we've got, an office in Ukraine. And by the way, Ukraine is under a constant barrage from Russian threat actors. So maybe we should isolate that office and put some additional controls in place that we wouldn't do for other offices. Maybe we need to do that. So I think factoring in geopolitical events, and this is really where intelligence is critical, factoring in geopolitical events into your daily operations and into what needs to be a running risk calculation. You can't assess risk once a year and come back and say, great, we're done. I mean, there's a lot of these factors that you need to continuously be evaluating every day, increasing amount of cyber capable operators out there.
Seems like we've seen a big tick up in these crypto mining scams. There seem to be a pivot away from ransomware and towards cryptojacking and crypto mining operations, obviously coinciding with a big run-up in the price of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. Do we expect that is a trend that will continue or at least follow the track of the Bitcoin price, or is that a flash in the pan?
Well, I think it's two things. 100%, I think that we see an increase in crypto mining and other crypto-based attacks. I think that adversaries are starting to diversify away from Bitcoin itself, and they're looking at other things like Monero and Ethereum and Dash and some of the other cryptocurrencies that are out there because there's more opportunity in some of those things. And there's a little bit, you know, some of these tend to be more anonymous than even Bitcoin, which is attractive, I think, for some of these threat actors. So we have seen an increase, especially in the last 3 or 4 months. Ever since Bitcoin kind of topped out at the end of 2017, we've seen an increase in cryptocurrency being either mining or directly attacking exchanges and even malware that was traditionally used to steal credit card information and things like that is now looking for crypto wallets. And if you think about it, I mean, Goldman Sachs, I think, opened up a cryptocurrency trading desk. And, you know, this is people are starting to take cryptocurrency seriously. Now, there's a lot of legislation and things that have been rumored or talked about now, which certainly is a concern, I think. But the threat actors for right now, there's money to be made off of cryptocurrency, and they're flocking towards it.
I wonder, especially, you know, here in the U.S., there's a lot of attention focused on the 2018 midterms and whether, you know, the Russians are going to be back for the midterms. If you think within some of these countries there might be a recalibration of their feelings about the effectiveness of these operations, whether they are really low cost or not, you know, again, that we might see in 2018. So kind of a cooling off of some of these more overt operations as countries kind of weigh the impact to them in the long term of carrying them out.
I don't think that they're going to cool it off. I think that they change how they do it, and they're taking steps to make it more difficult to figure out where these attacks are coming from, and they're doing things like making it look like ransomware when in fact it's not ransomware. So I think that they recognize the problems that these attacks can bring, or the attention these attacks can bring. But I think that the attractiveness of how to conduct these operations and the benefits of these operations outweigh you know, some of the negative attention that comes to it.
Do you see major powers like the United States and the Five Eyes nations starting to punch back in ways that maybe they have been unwilling to do thus far?
I think that, you know, obviously I don't have much visibility into that being in the commercial sector, but, you know, I think we're seeing that they're starting to think about how to be more effective at combating this, whether it's criminal or it's nation states. So, I mean, we've seen DOJ take action against a number of threat actors. We've seen whether it's calling out some Iranians or some Chinese or looking at Russian troll factories or arresting criminals that are involved in targeting of, you know, U.S. businesses. I think that they're figuring out how to be more, how they can apply some of the tools that they have at their disposal a little bit more effectively.
Adam Meyer of the firm CrowdStrike, thank you so much for coming on board the Security Ledger.
Sure thing.
Hey, this is Paul from the Security Ledger. If you're hearing my voice now, it means that you're a loyal listener of the Security Ledger podcast. To thank you for listening, we've got a special Easter egg offering, a one-of-a-kind Security Ledger t-shirt with a cool custom IoT security-themed artwork. Quantities are limited. To get yours, just go to securityledger.com/t-shirt and fill out the order form. We'll ship it to you, and be sure to include the special code to qualify for the order. That is SLT2018, SLT as in Security Ledger, T as in T-shirt, 2018 as in it's 2018. And up next, you don't need a demographer to tell you that the information security industry has a diversity problem. One look out at the sea of white, bearded faces at any security event should be enough. By official estimates, just 3% of information security professionals are Black, even though 12% of the U.S. population is. In recognition of Black History Month in February, we're sitting down with Black professionals who are surviving and thriving in the information security field to hear their stories, in the hopes that we can understand both what draws men and women of color to cybersecurity and, in some cases, what might be keeping them away. Our guest this week is Leon Thomas. He's the principal penetration tester at the firm Rapid7 and a longtime information security professional. In this segment, Leon talks to us about growing up as the son of divorced parents in Texas, half Black, half Hispanic, and the first person in his family to go to college. Leon tells us that the road to cybersecurity wasn't always straight or without bumps for him, but that he stuck with it and that his stubbornness is what he owes a lot of his success to. I started off by asking him to talk to us just about his childhood and whether he was always interested in technology.
My name is Leon Johnson. I'm a principal pen tester at Rapid7. My job is to break things. But as a principal pen tester, it sometimes lead the research and ideas, so kind of spearhead ideas and projects here at Rapid7.
So if we could go back a little bit, were your mom and or dad, you know, engineers or computer people, or was this kind of your own thing?
No. In fact, my parents were divorced at an early age. My mom did not go to college. In fact, nobody in my mom's family. I'm half Hispanic and half Black. And my mom's side are a bunch of ranchers. For the most part, horse riding, hands, or like outdoorsmen type people. And I've always literally been the Black sheep of my family on my mom's side, because not only am I Black, but I'm not into those things.
It's your term, not theirs, I hope.
Yeah.
So they were kind of rural folks. They worked off the land.
Yeah, for the most part. My mom went to college, but I don't think she finished. And so she was extremely encouraging. When I graduated high school, my plan was to go to ITT, because I wasn't raised in a family that was kind of like, you're expected to go to college, which I didn't know then, but I know now seems to be the norm for a lot of people. When I graduated, I was just going to go to ITT, get a skill set, and go get a job. And my mom encouraged me to go to college. She said, just to try it out, see if you'd like it, because no one has done it. And I ended up really liking it so much. In fact, I was there for quite some time, like 10 years, in fact, at UTSA, and, kind of just hanging out, playing basketball, studying computer science and psychology.
Yeah.
In fact, I think I was maybe two or three classes short of a math major. When I was finished, because I had so many classes, I could have had 3 degrees, but it became kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, somebody had to pull you aside at some point and say, you know, Leon, generally people graduate from this organization.
Yeah. I got a lot of jokes from my family, like, you're still in college? You're still in college? My rebuttal usually, I bet I finish before you do. So, yeah.
And your dad also not in a technical field?
Well, so my mom told me that she got my dad to go. She got him to the position he was. He worked at Phillips 66. He's no longer with us, but when he was there, he was an operator.
Yeah.
I always imagined, and based on the pictures I've seen, I've never been to his job, but I always kind of imagined he was basically a Homer Simpson, the Black Homer Simpson. He just had a thing, like looked at, you know, nodes or whatever. He wasn't particularly savvy with computers or anything, though he did buy a computer. He had money because of the job. And so we had a computer before we had internet. Before internet was a thing, he had this big old block computer at the house, and I remember I played solitaire on it, and I thought to myself, this big thing is here to play solitaire and to be a Rolodex, because he had his address book in it. Just kind of like, I don't get it.
Were you always interested in computers? Not so much, or was that something that kind of happened when you got to college?
Yeah, not at all. So though I had a computer there, I didn't have anybody that was into them, or it wasn't like you hear in the movies where all these people had all this culture and things. Now, my mom talked me into going to college. I went to college. I took intro to computer science because I knew computers were taking off and that was going to be a subject of interest, and I knew there'd be money behind it. And I took a liking to programming. I really liked the problem solving aspect of it. Mm-hmm. I found it quite cathartic, and I spent a lot of time in the computer lab because I didn't have my own computer. Mm-hmm. So I was in the computer lab just programming. And when I first started programming, it was Fortran.
Wow. Okay. You just dated yourself there.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing your high school, not much of a computer science program to speak of in high school.
No. So I went to 3 different high schools because of the divorce. And so the first high school I went to, which it was in Houston, which is funny to me because that school had a low success rate, generally speaking, as far as graduates and people going to college. However, facility speaking wise, they had the nicest facilities. Like all our lockers had locks built into them. We had a 2-story library. It was a really nice school. It just, nobody seemed to be excelling. The teachers weren't engaged, if you ask me. And so, but that school, there was a class that I was taking. I don't remember the name of the class, but we were soldering in that class.
Wow.
And we were soldering boards. Yeah. And I left that class started, and then I moved to Bay City, Texas, Uh-huh. And they didn't have an equivalent class, so they put me in farm and ranch. And I remember being so disgusted from going to soldering boards to literally the first day I showed up, they were taking a test. And the teacher told me, well, I know you haven't been here, but you can take a look at the test. You don't have to take it, but just take a look at it so you can kind of get an idea of the material we're covering. And it was literally a picture of like a wrench and screwdriver. And it was like, label these items. This is a flathead screwdriver or a Phillips screwdriver. And I was like, are we serious? This is what we're doing? I go, man, this sucks.
Yeah, can I just fast forward to the final, actually, and then I can have this time off? Yeah. I think I can pass it. Okay.
It wasn't until like college till I actually got my teeth into something that was interesting to my mind, if you will.
Yeah, it's so funny because, you know, when you look at the information security field, obviously there is tremendous lack of diversity within the field, not just, you know, racial diversity, but also gender diversity. That is a problem. But the bigger problem is almost the stuff that you're talking about.
No exposure. Yeah. All my friends growing up, I had probably two or three good friends in high school who I take credit for their success, the success that they have in their life. And it was really, I talked them, they weren't going to go to ITT. And I talked them to going to ITT. And they became, two of them became architects. And if it wasn't for that, they probably would, who knows what they'd be doing. But
yeah, there's so much of this. Yeah. It's just what's around you when you're growing up and what you see your parents doing and your parents' friends doing and your friends' parents doing or siblings.
Without a doubt.
And if you grow up in a community where, you know, that's not happening, it's very hard to know that it's even out there. It's almost like it's like a alien planet or something.
Yeah. Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. You need to be exposed to.
So when you got into doing computer science, how did you get to security from that? Because information security is not generally a part of the undergraduate CS curriculum. But
so originally what I was into was gaming, and I thought that maybe I'd get a job as a video game programmer. And so I started going to seminars, and whenever people who worked in the gaming industry would come to our college, I would go to those talks and just listen to see what, and it was quite daunting. I had a lot of, I don't know if they were trying to scare us or maybe it was true. I just didn't. I remember one person came. He worked for it was a gaming engine company. They wrote the physics engine for games, and other video games use their physics engine to run their platform. And the guy said, to work at our company, you have to have a degree in physics, mathematics, and computer science. And I was like, these are like the three hardest degrees you can get. And if you have all, and he said he had three. And I was thinking, if you have those three degrees, I don't know if I'll feel fulfilled working in a gaming industry. I feel like there's so much more you could do.
Right.
You could change
Shouldn't
the world.
Shouldn't it be at NASA or something?
Yeah, exactly. Right. I was like, I don't know, you know. Yeah. So it didn't make sense to me. I didn't buy it. And so I kind of stopped looking at the gaming industry, and I decided maybe I'd go work for like the FBI or the CIA. And so I found out through some research that they did a lot of hiring through Poly University in New York. And my plan was to graduate and try to apply to grad school at Poly University. And I failed a class that prevented me from going. I had plans. I had already got accepted under, my grades weren't great, but they accepted me under probationary like trial method, if you will. And because I failed that class, I had to get a job because I only had to take one more class again. So I had a whole semester of taking one class, and I had a lot of free time on my hands. So I ended up applying for jobs on campus, and I got a job with the Center for Infrastructure Assurance and Security, which ended up being a bunch of old hacker guys who were part of a community called 303. They were kind of older gentlemen now, that no longer in their mischievous days, but they were around doing a lot of that stuff, you know, kind of breaking edge type thing. And so they kind of took me under their wing and introduced me to a lot of people before I knew anything. So before I even knew like what an MMAP scan was or anything, like, they were introduced to people like H.D. Moore and just like big names in the industry. And so I just kind of started hanging out with those guys, and they were all making way more money than I was. And my goal at the time was just to make money like them. They told me, well, if you get your CISSP, we'll give you like a $30,000 raise. I was like, say no more. So I studied for like, you know, 3 months with no TV, just trying to get that certification. So I got the certification. But by the time I was gaining knowledge at such an accelerated rate at that point, that by the time I got that raise, I was no longer satisfied with it. I kind of wanted more. And I ran into a friend from college while at lunch one day, and he told me he was a pen tester. And I was like, what is that? And he's like, oh, I get paid to hack things. I was like, what? You get paid to do what? And he was like, I'm hacking stuff, man. And I go, how much did they pay you to do that, man? And he told me, and it was like another $30,000 more than I was making. I was like, that's it. I went back to work, and I just started applying like crazy. And I ended up talking myself into a job in Austin.
It's like somebody telling you to get paid to eat Skittles or something, you know?
Yeah.
So you're an African-American man in a field where only 3% of professionals, working professionals, are men and women of color. I think around 10% are women, 90% men. What do you think is the recipe for changing that around? And I'm guessing you can probably look back and compare yourself to the kids, you know, you grew up with and went to high school with, and see the benefit of the education that you received. So I guess how do you extend that to more people like yourself?
It's a good question, and it's a question that I've gotten a lot, and not necessarily just based on the community that I come from, but just in general, people are interested in getting into this field and they don't know where to start or how to do it. I
don't know. I don't have the answer to that. I recently got engaged to a she's black and white. Her name's Talia, and she's very much militant. She's very, as you were, down for the cause and wants to.
Woke.
Yeah, exactly. She's very much into doing that, and that's never been my. I don't know. I wouldn't say my MO, because I'm happy to help. It's not something I've ever pursued myself.
Yeah. Congratulations, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. She mentors a little kid, and she's struggling with him and trying to make sure, you know, he does right. But it's not easy just because of the obstacles that are in place.
Well, what's really interesting about your story is you just seem like you're just like a very determined person. And as you said, kind of a stubborn person. And you just kept kind of plowing ahead in your, particularly in your early life, you know, where you were really in terra incognito with so much of this. You know, you didn't have anyone in your family to like bounce stuff off of. But it shouldn't have to be, you know, you shouldn't have to necessarily have those personality qualities to be able to get up and get into the field, you know, like, but there isn't. You know, I mean, it's just hard.
Yeah.
You know, I think one of the things that may prevent people from getting in our industry, and I'm actually just thinking about this right now, is it tends to be a somewhat egotistical industry.
Mm.
A lot of people in our field have big egos.
Mm-hmm. And not great social skills.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I suspect it kind of goes hand in hand. So maybe because they're not social, they lean on their what security prowess they have, and they try to play that up, and as a result, it's not welcoming to people who are novices in this industry. And so people are unsure of things to ask or how it will be received, and they don't want to seem like they don't know what they're talking about, and including people who have been doing this for years. No one wants to look dumb. And so one of the things that I've noticed, or that's helped me out, is, you know, I've gotten to a certain point where I'm comfortable with what I know and what I don't know. And I know enough that I don't feel any kind of way about that. But when I first moved to Austin, I joined the Austin Hackers Anonymous group, or AHA, Austin Hackers Academy, some people call it, or they call it whatever. When I first started there, I was the only black guy there. And it was a small community. It was like maybe 5 or 6 guys there. Okay. So there was no hiding. And their motto was, if you show up, you have to speak. So, you know, I just spoke about what I knew, and maybe they knew about it, maybe they didn't know about it. But what I noticed was there was a lot of people there that it wasn't the most social group of guys. They were just kind of people showing off what they knew. And I noticed that it started growing. And one day I went to, it was B-Sides in Austin. And there was at least, I want to say about 5 to 10 of us who all went to AHA. And we started getting drunk and had conversations, and we got to know each other really, really well. And it was funny how you see how much people have the imposter syndrome, and everybody was just opening up, and everybody was like, oh yeah, I thought you were too cool for school guy. And I thought you, you know, and everybody has this preconceived notions of what everyone else is doing, and it leads to a certain industry. And I think women and minorities, because they see these group of guys that are, they have something in common, while it's not the most welcoming thing to do. When I was there, the only reason I stayed was because I'm stubborn. You're not going to intimidate me to leave anywhere. If you tell me, and if you tell me I don't know something, maybe I don't. But you know what? I'll learn it, and I'll prove you wrong. And so it's not a. But that's not necessarily the way you want to get people into the field, right? You don't want to challenge people. You don't want to make it a hostile thing.
No, I mean, it's all modeling, right? I mean, that's how all of us kind of find our way in life is, you know, you look around you and see what other people are doing. And if you find people who you admire or relate to, that's a very powerful incentive or draw to pursue that yourself, right? So, yeah, I mean, challenging people or putting up barriers, that's not exactly the right way to do it. But you do have to put people in the right positions where they're going to be seen and have a chance to impress and model for people who are coming up.
I think maybe like outreach programs or something of that nature of going to historically underutilized communities and doing workshops and teaching people. I feel like they're underfunded, so they don't even have the resources. I didn't have a computer until I was a senior. My father asked me, we didn't have the best relationship, and he asked me after I'd been programming for I don't know how many years, hey, you still need a computer? I'm like, well, I'm going to graduate next year, so that might be useful. And you can't take it apart if you don't have it. So I knew how to program, but I didn't know anything about networking. I didn't know anything about, I remember I went home and my mom told me to fix the router, and I was like, I don't know how to do that. And she's like, what do you mean you don't know how to do that? You've got a degree in computer science. I go, I don't have a router to do it too. So I had to learn. Right. I mean, I was like, all right, I'll learn. And I learned, and it wasn't hard, but it's funny to me that, you know, I didn't have that skill set because I didn't have the necessary equipment to learn it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. It's funny. I mean, as you know, these are solvable problems, but it sometimes it just doesn't seem like there's really a will socially within the United States to solve them. You know, I mean, I don't know. It's like a $18 trillion economy. It's a $4 trillion federal budget. Somehow I think if we wanted to like, you know, you know, provide, you know, at-risk communities with the resources and people to develop the skill set. I mean, it's like, you know, I look at you and it's like, how many other Leon Johnsons are there out there who have your background, but not maybe your combination of skills and experiences to get where you've gotten? And that's just, you know, that's talent. That's just
squandered.
You know, that the society really needs. It's squandered. Yeah, that's a great word. That's right. Yeah. Hey, Leon, thank you so much for talking to the Security Ledger podcast. It's been great.
Cool, man. Thank you for your time, and thanks for giving me a call.
Leon Johnson is a principal penetration tester at the firm Rapid7.